Okay, I think we should start. Thanks for coming, everybody. And let me welcome our speaker, Adis Merzanovic. He's a postdoctoral research fellow at CSOX at St. Anthony's College in the University of Oxford. He has a PhD in political science from the University of Zurich. And he was previously Swiss fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. He is currently doing his postdoctoral research at CSOX, as I mentioned, funded by the Swiss National Science Foundation, looking at challenges of liberalism in the Western Balkans in light of the region's European Union membership. The topic on which he's going to talk to us today focuses not in the Western Balkans in general, but on Bosnia in particular. And Bosnia is the place, the area where Adis has also done his doctoral research. He published a book out of that in 2015 on democracy by decree, prospects and limits of imposed conditional democracy in Bosnia. Consociational democracy in Bosnia and Herzegovina. Adis, the floor is yours. You can have a presentation around 45 minutes, and I will open it up for questions and answers.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Vaziz, for the kind invitation to speak here today, and thank you, everybody, for coming. Before we begin, I have to apologize. I was fighting a rather strong cold the last week, so my voice sounds a bit nasal. I will try to speak as loudly as I can. Since the end of the 1992 to 1995 war in Bosnia, the country has been involved in a profound transition process that was supposed to take it from the post-war stabilizing efforts of the Dayton Peace Agreement to full-fledged membership in the European Union. Apart from the many practical challenges on this road from Dayton to Brussels, as it was called, there exists a deeper, more fundamental obstacle that the country has to overcome in order to join the prestigious club of democratic and economically interlinked nations. Bosnia's current political system follows the logic of consociational power sharing, primarily accommodating the interests and rights of the three ethno-nationalist groups, the so-called constituent peoples, the Serbs, Bosniaks and Croats. Yet as part of the integration process, the European Union, implicitly or explicitly, insists on the establishment of a liberal democracy that legitimizes itself primarily towards the individual. Liberal democratic values have been central to the EU's engagement with the entire Western Balkans regions, and particularly with Bosnia and Herzegovina. But efforts to instill these principles have hit enormous domestic roadblocks. And in fact, when I started this research, I used to say, I work on liberalism in the Western Balkans, and then people would respond, good, tell us when you find the research subject. You know, so even though the title, as you correctly mentioned, is Challenges of Liberalism. I mean, but at the same time, there is the once predicted notion of liberal democracy's dialectical triumph as the only game in town seems challenged on so many fronts today. Globally, as well as regionally, we observe tendencies of democratic backsliding and a rise in illiberalism and authoritarianism that most often find their ideological foundation in protectionism and nationalism and their voice in populism. While nationalist sentiments have been omnipresent in Bosnia's post-war political scene, it is especially liberalism's insistence on market liberalization and privatization that has left much of the population disenchanted with the liberal democratic model itself. And it is for that reason that apart from the liberal model, other ideological models have been proposed for the country's future, most prominently perhaps more direct forms of citizen engagement, as articulated during the protest movements in 2014, about which I will talk, or the more theoretical notion of direct referendum-based democracy for Bosnia, put forward by my colleague Nenad Stojanovic. In this talk, I shall evaluate these three alternatives to the current system and talk to you about the chances for liberalism. However, whenever we evaluate something, we face a common problem, which is selecting our evaluation criteria. We could, for example, define an ideal type scenario for a functioning state by using a specific set of principles on which we all agree, like transparency, good governance, accountability, efficiency, legal protection, or simply a citizen's capability to meaningfully influence the political process. The problem with these kind of evaluative criteria is, of course, their inherently liberal bias. So if we use criteria that are skewed towards the liberal model to actually evaluate the aptness of the liberal model, we end up with something, and now the picture makes sense, we end up with something that Star Trek fans might call a reverse Kobayashi Maru. In other words, a test designed to succeed, which of course renders the results meaningless. To avoid this trap, we need to take a holistic approach and evaluate the proposed models not from a particular ontological perspective, but from a number of different perspectives. Therefore, the goal is to analyze liberalism and each alternative by discussing first the underlying legitimizing structure, their aptness to act as a remedy to the critiques leveled against the current system, which come from different camps, and their practical chances of being adopted. In order to do so practically, I think we need to start with an understanding of the current problems and challenges in Bosnia. Bosnia's current political system is often described, as I said, as a corporate consociation that accommodates the three groups through four specific instruments, institutions: grand coalition governments, in which all the three ethnic groups are included; proportional group representation in government and parliament, which in the Bosnian case sometimes exceeds the necessities of proportionality; group autonomy through an asymmetrically organized federal structure, the Republika Srpska on the one hand, and the federation with its 10 cantons on the other; and fourthly, far-reaching veto powers that allow each of the three constituent peoples to block legislation that they deem harmful to their group interests. As a post-war setup, consociationalism is criticized for enshrining ethnic divisions into the system rather than offering a way to overcome them. Using a term popularized by the Bosnian political scientist Arsim Mujkic, Bosnia may be described as an ethnopolis, a community characterized by the primacy of ethnic belonging over the individual, a system based on the ethnos, not the demos. Since many see ethnic divisiveness as a major factor leading to the war in the first place, the reproduction and revaluation of ethno-national distinctions through the systemic setup is often regarded as problematic. Keeping the ethno-national cleavage salient, so the argument goes, precludes any kind of social transformation. What is more, it actually legitimizes ethnic politics, making it impossible for the citizen to exist outside of ethnicity. Bosnia's consociational system furthermore actively condones discriminatory provisions due to its system of reserving seats exclusively to members of the three constituent peoples, which has been criticized by the European Court on Human Rights four times so far. On a more practical level, consociationalism in Bosnia de facto divides up the electorate into distinct ethno-national groups leading to practices of ethnic outbidding in electoral campaigns. Respective electoral provisions create centrifugal effects and preclude the emergence of a truly cross-ethnic candidate, as well as any cleavages other than the ethno-nationalist one. The highly decentralized nature of the polity makes this problem even worse. Dayton is said to have created largely independent and exclusive ethnic domains, entities and cantons, which are ruled not by the institutions of the state, but by the powers of the ethnic elites. Therein lies a major point of attack against consociationalism, namely its reliance on what Arndt Leiphardt once called the rule by elite cartel. Political rule in Bosnia is furthermore absolutist, in the sense that the government controls the entire state apparatus. The governing parties have numerous political and administrative positions to fill, which they do by employing party members, supporters, or their respective relatives. And in fact, a quite common joke in Bosnia goes as follows: why are there no extramarital affairs in Bosnian ministries? Because everybody is related. Furthermore, due to Bosnia's legacy of socialism, major industries have had to be privatized after the war, with the political elites overseeing this process, which of course opened up plenty of opportunities for corruption and abuses of office. Naturally, this affects the quality of Bosnian democracy, in addition to being detrimental to the mere idea of true democratic pluralism and, for example, a free media. This system is self-perpetuating, because open democratic contestation would both undermine the legitimacy of consolidated clientelism and disrupt the operations of a lucrative set of political and economic arrangements. Furthermore, because the government's record benefited more from a party's ability to provide for its clientele than from the actual consequences of their policies, which were oftentimes left to the internationals to impose, policy as such became more or less disposable. As a consequence, the system was unable to internally provide principles such as transparency, accountability, and good governance. Bosnia also experienced the phenomenon of shallow Europeanization. Reforms requested by the European Union were selectively adopted, but whether or not they were ever truly implemented depended, and still depends, on the interest structures of the political elites. When the requested reforms threatened the established power balances, for example, through the implementation of rule of law provisions that would actually target abuses of office and corruption, the elites, quite expectedly, stalled them. The office of the High Representative pushed through some reforms. However, external imposition became more and more difficult to defend over time, resulting in political deadlocks. Ultimately, Bosnia and Herzegovina became ungovernable on its own terms. What made this system appear both legitimate and necessary, especially from an outside point of view, is the possibility of ethno-national instability, or even war, which is why suggestions to dismantle the current system are commonly met by the escalation of the ethno-nationalist and wartime rhetoric. From this perspective, it seemed logical to keep the same elites in place so as to prevent further harm. So this is the situation in which we find ourselves today, and in fact nothing that I've said today is original so far. The question is, acknowledging that this situation is bad, the question is where do we move from here? And I think we need to discuss these alternatives in a more structured way in order to answer that question. So let us start with the most obvious alternative to the current system, which comes from the liberal model. In order to determine what a liberal model for Bosnia would mean, we need to first define precisely what we understand under liberalism. I will not bore you with a lengthy theoretical discussion about different forms of liberalism, even though if you want, in the Q&A, but just say that defining liberalism is a complex task, as there is no single and ambiguous thing called liberalism. Rather, we are confronted with what my Oxford colleague Timothy Garton Ash calls a conceptual cacophony. That, to be analytically useful, is a need of substantial reduction with the goal of producing clear-cut conceptual categories. So to this end, I distinguish three forms of liberalism in an empirical, not normative way. Political, economic, and social. Under political liberalism, I understand a principle encompassing three general ideas. First, a set of inalienable rights or basic political and personal freedoms that the state may not infringe upon due to the Kantian notion of moral equality of all citizens. Second, a fundamental set of principles by which the state is to be run, particularly the rule of law, governmental accountability, transparency, and the protection of the individual from arbitrary state coercion. And thirdly, an institutional setup that centers on the principles of a separation of powers with checks and balances, and usually, though not exclusively, a system of representative democracy. Economic liberalism, the second category, rests on basically two notions. Firstly, the Lockean idea that by mixing work with what nature had produced, meaning natural resources, the individual gained an absolute right over the product, the work product, and could thus do with it whatever she pleased. Precisely because the state cannot define an absolute system of values, or for that matter, morality, state intervention into the economic sector should be severely curtailed, basically reduced to securing the framework for the trade of goods and the enforcement of contracts, the invisible hand. Secondly, the notion that the free market is the best ordering mechanism to achieve societal wealth due to the entrepreneurial spirit that, almost by definition, furthest concentrates investment of profit and thus produces a growing economy. Today, this is the key idea behind neoliberalism. So empirically, I rely on a neoliberal understanding of economic liberalism, which focuses on free policies, deregulation of economy, liberalization of trade and industry, and privatization of state-owned enterprises. The third aspect of liberalism is what I call social liberalism, or what is commonly called as social egalitarianism. Taking the Kantian morality formula seriously means concluding that social advantages and privileges in a society based on, for example, birth or natural talents cannot be justified from a liberal perspective, especially when they lead to severe inequalities in the society. Social liberalism sees social goods as derivatives of individual freedoms. It argues that just as individuals have a right to maximize their well-being, so do societies. For a society to achieve this goal, social liberalism asserts the state's obligation to care for the least well-off and to strive towards social justice and a fair, though not necessarily equal, distribution of goods and resources. Practically speaking, this presupposes an active role for the government in addressing issues of social inequalities through welfare schemes, benefits, and interventionist policies. So these are my definitional criteria in the shortest way I could present them. Now, coming to the case of Bosnia and Herzegovina, we immediately see how a liberal understanding directly questions certain core principles of the system. Putting the focus on the individual and his or her rights and interests directly attacks the group-based functioning logic of consociationalism. On paper, The prevailing problem is political liberalism. The principle of equality puts into question the different quotas for members of constituent peoples. And even if we follow more communitarian approaches to the political liberalism, for example, as advocated by Will Kimlicka, we have to conclude that while giving certain groups particular advantages in a political system so as to protect them might not necessarily be liberal, if you exclude group members from particular positions within the state, certainly is illiberal. In fact, as many of you know, what started with the case of Devo Sedic and Jakub Finci, who belonged to the Roma and Jewish community, respectively, in front of the European Court of Human Rights in 2009, has since become a perpetual roadblock on Bosnia's path towards the European Union. The politicians proved so far unable to change the constitution so as to allow minority representatives to run for and hold offices in the state presidency or the upper house of parliament. Now, if we conclude that the implementation of the Sedic-Finci verdict is impossible because there is no substantial agreement on the underlying principle of non-discrimination, then we have to conclude that liberalism in its political form does not stand a chance in Bosnia. However, I don't think that we should make this kind of conclusion for two reasons. The first one is liberalism is already present in Bosnia. The final award of Brčko, which was rendered by the arbitration tribunal chaired by Lord Owen in 1999, clearly broke the consociation logic of group accommodation by making the municipality a district under the direct supervision of the central state rather than part of one or the other entity. As Asimovic writes, basing their decisions on reasons related to justice and fairness, the arbiters, firstly, reaffirmed the principle of equality, thus distributing it to all citizens of a given political community, not this or that social or political group. Secondly, they reaffirmed the rule of law, the rule of generality over particularity, by which the law is understood as an abstract concept that applies to all situations and all citizens equally. The peculiar system of Brčko that thus institutionalizes abstract equality among the residents of the municipality and introduces limitations on political rule. In this sense, the existing system is inherently liberal, meaning that we may not a priori exclude liberalism as a tangible alternative. Secondly, coming back to the Sedic-Finci verdict, there is something to be said about the debate surrounding its implementation. The major problem has not been that the underlying principle of non-discrimination is questioned, but rather that once the constitutional setup was opened up for debate, the discussions have been hijacked by the elites of the constituent peoples that actually started fighting for other constitutional changes that would benefit them and their group directly. And of particular importance in this context is, of course, what the Croat nationalist elite refer to as the new Croat question, meaning both the fact that Bosnian Croats don't have an entity of their own because they perceive the federation to be a Bosniak-dominated entity, and the fact that it is technically possible for a Croat member of the presidency to be elected by Bosniak votes. These are highly politicized debates that concern issues of political representation and identity and culture, but they do not, in principle, impede on the chances of a liberal regime. In fact, the proper implementation of the principles of political liberalism would also resolve the issues of forced ethnicization of the individual and minimize the effects of reproducing ethnic cleavages. Furthermore, a more cleverly designed electoral system that would have to be installed after the end of the ethnic quotas might work as a remedy for the tendencies of ethnic outbidding. Equally, introducing a functioning system of checks and balances in which the judiciary is not hostage to the elite, the bureaucracy work efficiently and independently, and governmental rule is not absolute would remedy these criticisms against the system as well and return agency to the population. So in essence, political liberalism would serve as a remedy to many of the contemporary criticisms that I have listed. Now, this is hardly surprising, because, in fact, it is tautological. Many of the criticisms that I've listed come from liberals. Of course, the solution is a liberal model. We are right back at the reverse Kobayashi Maru. Personally, I believe that the problem for advocates of political liberalism in Bosnia has not necessarily been the normative justification of the underlying principles. This can be achieved. The real problem has been the active support of, or at least complacency in, illiberal practices by advocates of liberalism. The international community in Bosnia, both in terms of the OHR and the European Union, has put forward a somewhat ambiguous model for Bosnia by wanting it to politically liberalize a consociational system. While it is possible to make the argument that you should have, for example, an independent judiciary and the rule of law in the consociational system, even if there are some consociationalists who critically look at human rights and courts in terms of stabilizing post-war societies with the consociational model. But I think it is possible to make the argument that you should have judiciary, independent judiciary, and the rule of law. It is much harder to explain why you should not have group privileges or discriminatory provisions or an electoral system that reflects and protects group interests, given the entire group-based logic of the system. In my opinion, a far more difficult problem is that reforms pertaining to the realm of political liberalism have always been presented to the public as means rather than ends. This is, in fact, a fairly common feature for post-war Bosnia, where reforms are not truly debated but simply declared necessary, either for visa-free travel, signing the Stabilization and Association Agreement, or joining the European Union. Now, there is nothing wrong with saying that a particular reform is necessary for any of these goals. What is wrong, however, is to subsequently assert that that reform is therefore not in need of deliberation, justification, and legitimization through the respective political institutions. No reform is ubiquitously positive, for it always creates winners and losers. Simply because something is part of the EU acquis or necessary for the SAA does neither make it a priori good nor right for a particular context. It certainly does not absolve it from critical scrutiny. Quite to the contrary, understanding the production of commonly binding rules, norms, and regulations, which is politics, in such a manner is not only inherently incompatible with democracy, but actually quite subversive to the mere idea of democratization. Whenever public debate is silenced and decision capacity is delegated to non-legitimate bodies, such as cliques of party leaders or business interests, democratization and liberalization take a step back. And the question is, how many steps back can you take before you lose sight of liberal democracy? However, in my opinion, the major problem for liberalism taking hold in Bosnia and Herzegovina lies not in the political component, as political strategies and behavior may be adapted. The bigger problem is the prevalence of economic and the absence of social liberalism. The international community and, in particular, the European Union's insistence on economic liberalization as part of the post-war stabilization and normalization efforts of a socialist economic system meant that enterprises were privatized, thus in essence robbing the people of their socio-economic base. Had ordinary citizens once had a say in how their enterprises were run, however marginal that say might have been in under the system of worker self-management, their factories were now either destroyed or in the hands of a usually kleptocratic post-war elite, and their jobs, should they be so lucky to have one, anything but safe. Any sense of social justice was lost when neoliberalism took hold of the economic, social, and not seldom political processes and produced many, many losers. As I explained, liberalism as an ideological concept is not incapable of addressing these issues of extensive neoliberalism and the lack of social security. Yet as part of the post-war stabilization and normalization process, not much emphasis has been put on the requirements of social liberalism. This does not mean that the state was not involved in subsidizing ordinary citizens, but rather, as Larisa Kurtovic writes, that models of social distribution were privatized, politicized, and transformed into clientelist tools by the dominant political parties. That this socially volatile situation would, in due time, create a backlash against the political elites was perhaps anything but surprising, particularly to people familiar with the counter-movement theory put forward by Karl Polanyi. This, of course, brings us to the protest movements of 2014 and the notion of citizen-based democracy, as I have called it. The 2014 protests did not come out of nothing, but there were particularly two events that may be seen as precursors. The first happened in 2012 in Banja Luka, when a construction company began excavating pits in park so as to develop commercial and residential property on the site. To save the park, the citizens took to the streets. And apart from the project, they opposed the close connection between political and business interests that excluded the citizens. Ultimately, their efforts proved to be in vain, and the park was actually destroyed. Nevertheless, the experiences of citizens uniting around a particular political issue would be repeated only a year later with the baby revolution. Political quarrels between the ruling elites made it impossible for newborns to get citizen identification numbers, which also prevented them from being issued identification papers such as passports or ID cards. As a consequence, three months old Belmina Ibišević was unable to travel to Serbia to receive necessary medical treatment. Her case spurred a large-scale public protest in front of the parliament building in Sarajevo. At one point, the ever-growing masses of protesters, among them many women with their children, literally blocked the exits of the parliament, incarcerating the politicians within it. They threatened not to let them exit until a solution was found. Eventually, the politicians agreed, first on an interim and later on a permanent new law. Little Belmina, however, could not be saved and died soon after. The February 2014 protests were somewhat different, for they were simultaneously smaller and larger in scope than the preceding events. From the outset, they concerned workers' rights within the particular context of the city of Tuzla, an industrial town in eastern Bosnia. Tuzla suffered greatly in the post-war period as a result of a particularly vicious and destructive process of privatization. Before the war, its largest company, the Sodaso complex, that brought together a number of smaller companies, was known throughout Yugoslavia for its production of salt, industrial chemicals, and household detergents. Today, many of its former subsidies, including Polyohem, Dita, and Solana, are in serious economic trouble. They were privatized after the war. Most of the new owners then either stripped the companies for parts or laid off significant segments of the workforce. Those that still had a job were not paid much and sometimes not for longer periods of time. After many rounds of negotiations, strikes and agreements not holding what they promised, the social time bomb ultimately exploded in the beginning of February 2014 when former and current workers began protesting in front of the cantonal building. The protests soon spread to Sarajevo, Bihać, Zenica, Mostar, and other towns throughout Bosnia, where thousands of workers and ordinary citizens took to the streets. In Sarajevo, there were even riots. As a result of the enlarged participation profile, the protests soon acquired a larger, more inclusive message. People were rallying against the governing kleptocratic political elites that ran the country to their own benefits, against the social poverty and injustice created by the irresponsible governmental system and particularly the botched privatization processes in the post-war period, and against the dismal living conditions in which many ordinary citizens could not find employment, had to suffer from hunger, or did not have adequate access to health care. What made this message even more powerful was the trans-ethnic and socio-economic character of the movement, expressed in one of the most famous banners that emerged, which is you see in the lower corner. We are hungry in all three languages. After an initial round of street rallies, the protesters chose to organize citizens' assemblies, open to all, so-called plenums, in which they produced concrete lists of demands directed at local, regional, and state governments. Four cantonal governments were eventually forced to resign as a result of such pressures, seemingly giving the protest movements a clear and tangible victory. But in actuality, the record of the protest movements is mixed at best. Getting rid of one government does not necessarily mean a change in policy. Moreover, the enormous floods that hit Bosnia in May 2014 destroyed the protesters' momentum, while their categorical refusal to participate in the existing political structure, meaning to stand in the upcoming October elections with an own list, meant that the movement slowly but surely disintegrated, ultimately allowing the domestic elites to ignore its demands. Nevertheless, the protest movements did reinvigorate the international attention for Bosnia, directly leading, for example, to the Anglo-German or later European initiative. More importantly, they impressively demonstrated that ethnicity might not be the only cleavage in contemporary Bosnia, and that there is a potential for civic society engagement based on economic and social issues, at least in the urban centers of the country. Now, analyzing the protests, when we do that, we need to start by stating that they emerged out of a specific socio-economic context, the contours of which were the result of a 20-odd year of political, social, and economic development, of 20-odd year process of political, social, and economic development. They were a complex phenomenon, and they unified diverse groups of individuals that, while sharing a similar assessment of the present, had rather different reasons to actually engage in the manifestations and the plenums. Surveying the literature that has since emerged, I believe there are two important lessons that we need to take away. Firstly, and maybe most importantly, is the emphasis that the protest movements put on social justice outside of the familiar and interest-based channels that operate in post-war Bosnia, by taking advantage of the ethno-nationally based state structure, the ruling elite has not only captured the state and the bureaucracies, but also, in a sense, dispossessed the population, especially those that refuse to participate in the ethnic hegemony. And if such critique sounds uncomfortably Marxist to your ears, then you may be right, but that in and of itself is not reason to negate its validity. More importantly than acknowledging the lack of social justice is the fact that the elites have de facto also depoliticized the public deliberative sphere by making access to state bureaucracies highly conditional on connection and patronage. Rather than understanding state institutions as serving the people's interests, the citizens oftentimes become beggars for their own right. And if you're familiar with the local language, I mean, whenever somebody has to get a passport, it's not I have to get a passport, but I have to chase the passport, is ganyati, which is quite telling in this context. That this situation needs to be rectified is, I believe, uncontested among the soberly thinking individuals. In fact, I would argue that the protest movement's legitimacy stems precisely from the fact that many in Bosnia agree with their demands. Secondly, the protests were certainly a sign of domestic political agency among the population, meaning in a collective form. The people stood up to the elites and demanded a fundamental change, not of policy, but of politics and society. The people, motivated by everyday grievances, became the driver of political change, belying, as Andrew Gilbert and Jasmin Mujanović claim, the image of Bosnia's population as ethnically divided, passive, and defeated. Yet the people that assembled were divided, not by ethnicity, but by different ideas, ideologies, and interests that brought them together. And this is precisely the point. In the words of Asim Mujic, the protests exhibited a democratic counterpower in the form of the multitude. And he says, unlike a people that is being produced to erase differences, to erase conflicts, to forge unity out of the many, the multitude, though it sometimes acts as one, preserves the differences and autonomy of its segments, their plurality of singularities. And when they coordinate their desire, a political subject emerges. In other words, a genuine demos is born. This demos, as opposed to the prevailing ethnos, chooses to operate not through the established channels of representation, but in a more direct form, through citizens' assemblies or the plenums. In the words of Damir Arsenievich, an academic and activist from Tuzla, the plenums are, quote, public gatherings open to any citizens through which collective decisions and demands can be made and action taken beyond guarantees of leadership. They are open, direct, and transparent forms of democracy in practice. They are a setting for speech beyond prohibition and censorship, a public space where, through calls for a different kind of justice, demands for equality are spoken. And finally, an instrument to enact emancipatory politics for a population kept in a situation in which politics as such was impossible. Now, there is much to unpack in this characterization of the plenums, but I shall limit myself to pointing out that the plenum structure, in reality, was not as inclusive as some might have hoped. Quite tellingly, it did not include the middle classes that actually benefit from the current system. In fact, due to the protesters' refusal to engage in party politics and form a party on their own, we do not know how many people in Bosnia actually support this style of politics. And even among the participants themselves, differences of opinion prevail, as you would expect in any forum composed of individuals with different ideas, backgrounds, and interests. Whenever you have a diverse group of people taking decisions, you need to have a particular rules in place beyond the voting mechanism of one person, one vote. This was quite difficult. As Emir Hodžić, a Sarajevo-based participant, tells us, he says, it turned out to be more difficult than predicted to have productive sessions, for instance, trying to prevent plenums from becoming psychotherapy sessions for traumatized citizens, some of whom spoke publicly for the first time about their situation. Or as Adis Sadikovic, an activist from Tuzla, says, some of the numerous demands that emerged at the protests were mutually exclusive, leading to the need to, quote, filter out the demands that would not benefit the workers. But what makes workers' demands superior to the ones of pensioners, students, the unemployed, or the young? Sadikovic goes on to say that the plenums offer the possibility to scrutinize every idea, saying that their main advantage is also a disadvantage, namely that there is no place to maneuver a political form of organization which would enable a particular tactical advantage for one particular position or view. So in other words, the plenums, if understood as a form of legitimate political organization, aimed at producing rules or norms and regulations, suffer from the usual problems any body of citizens voting by majority rule encounters. It is not immune to lobbying and side deals, and furthermore subject to mobilization effects by different interest groups, not to speak of the fact that there is no mechanism to prevent minorities from being permanently excluded from the decision-making process. Furthermore, the lack of clear leadership certainly poses problems in terms of implementing decisions. So before the system can become a tangible alternative for Bosnia, there is still much work to be done. However, I see the plenums as ideal forms to deliberate public policy, to actually check what the governing elites are doing, and to provide an additional avenue of legitimization that does not conform to the usual ethno-national division of the country. As such, it has the potential to open up the political space and actually give power to the multitude, to the demos. Now, if we develop this idea further of citizen assemblies checking the work of governing structure, we may say, why not simply replace citizens' assemblies through citizens, and in other words, introduce a true form of direct democracy? This, of course, brings us to the proposal put forward by my friend Nenad Stojanović. I know that discussing the merits of direct democracy in a post-Brexit Britain, in front of what I suppose, if this room is anything like Oxford, what I suppose is a largely pro-European audience, is challenging. I will not enter into a general debate about the merits of referenda, apart from simply saying that, as advocated by Francis Schoeneval recently, there is a qualitative difference between the plebiscitary use of referenda, which indeed may be legitimacy decreasing, and its direct democratic use, which is legitimacy enhancing. But we may discuss this in Q&A. I understand direct democracy as both a tool for citizens to challenge decisions by the authorities by putting them up for a vote, and a bottom-up tool for citizens to actually impose laws and regulations on the governed, provided the majority of citizens agrees to it. And therein lies the biggest problem of direct democracy in plural or divided society, namely the fact that it relies on simple majority rule, 50% plus one, which leaves minorities out. However, as Stojanović claims, direct democracy may also contribute to internal cohesion of a multi-ethnic society, and more specifically, may foster integration of minorities. Using the experiences of Switzerland, he identifies four main advantages of direct democratic instruments. Firstly, the bottom-up approach enables tiny minorities to raise issues which they deem important to the national political agenda. Secondly, the frequent use of direct democracy creates multiple majorities and multiple minorities, which enable everybody to be, depending on the issue, sometimes in the majority and sometimes in the minority. And at the same time, it makes this ethno-nationalist narrative of us versus them implausible. Thirdly, the practice of direct democracy at the national level promotes vertical integration and allows the emergence of a common demos. Fourthly, the fact that popular votes at the national level are held in a single voting district may produce centripetal effects of horizontal integration by providing incentives for politicians, parties, and interest groups to actually campaign cross borders. Naturally, when applied to Bosnia and Herzegovina, the word referendum as part of the direct democracy concept is rather problematic. It is often, though not exclusively, associated with disruptive and secessionist tendencies in Republika Srpska. While Republika Srpska's secession is a hollow threat, as James Kerlinski has argued, the mere notion, and the referendum is always part of a larger legal framework, making the recent day of the Republic referendum in Republika Srpska illegal according to the existing laws. The mere mention of a referendum is often enough to derail the political process and to produce centrifugal effects. And Stojanović is, of course, aware of this. So he has four recommendations on how to go about introducing direct democracy in Bosnia. Firstly, we need to think of it as a slow, gradual, and long-term process. It's not something to be introduced from today to tomorrow. Secondly, we need to start at the local level, where decisions have immediate effect and may be removed from the ethnicizing tendencies of the central state. Whether you want street lamps in your street does not really depend on your ethnicity, one might say. Thirdly, he proposes to exclude the possibility of communitarian and potentially divisive issues from the reach of direct democracy, so no ethnically sensitive stuff. And finally, he recommends a qualified majority for votes on constitutional amendments. I share much of Stojanović's descriptions of the potentials of direct democracy, which may be a particularly Swiss bias that he and I share. particularly the notion of an issue-based creation of different and temporarily limited majorities seems appealing and has indeed the potential of unifying the society. However, where I strongly disagree with him is the fact that in a post-war and highly ethnicized context like Bosnia, direct democratic decisions may be fully removed from the larger ethno-national context. As my colleague Daniel Boxler argues in a critical reply, there might be limits to the transferability of the Swiss model beyond the particulars of the Helvetic case. In some instances, direct democracy may result in a permanent mechanism, in a permanent political domination through the communal majority group, and Stojanovic security mechanisms, these four things, are unable to counter these detrimental tendencies at the moment. So until he presents a fuller, more elaborate argument for direct democracy in post-conflict settings, and I know he's working on that, there is much reason for skepticism, both on a theoretical and a practical level. But there is also much potential in the idea, which should not be discarded lightly, which is the reason why I included it here. So let me conclude. Neither direct democracy nor citizen-based democracy, as advocated by the protest movements, may at present serve as real alternatives for the post-war Bosnian setting, even if they provide important insights into the challenges we face. While they certainly must not be ignored, the choice in Bosnia and Herzegovina, as I see it, is essentially between the continuation of this ill-functioning consociational democracy with shallow Europeanization and the introduction of a true liberal democratic system. In this battle, liberalism has only a fighting chance if it is not merely understood in a technical manner, but as a comprehensive ideology, which firstly encompasses more deliberative avenues for legitimization of political action. Mere representative democracy is simply not enough, especially in a society that has lost much trust in the political institutions and the elites. Citizens' assemblies and direct democratic means might be employed to keep the self-centered elites in check, provide new avenues for democratic agency by the population at large. Secondly, liberalism needs to take more care of social justice. Only if it offers concrete counterproposals to the socioeconomic effects of large-scale economic liberalization and the botched privatization processes of the late 1990s and early 2000s are we really in a position to argue for liberalism as an alternative in Bosnia. The major challenge is not that liberalism is normatively, ideologically or theoretically incapable to reform itself in this way, but the major challenge is that it has not done so as a matter of political reality. Therefore, I believe it is now time for a new liberalism, a liberalism in practice, not in theory. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Edis.
And let me just say, if you're interested in the full text, the fully footnoted version, you may just contact me. Because there were a lot of quotes that I could not say.
Very good. Thanks. And thanks for finishing with a positive proposal about liberalism. I will open it up for questions, but as you kind of collect your thoughts and prepare your questions, can I just sort of start with a comment and then end up with a question? So I thought it was, I hadn't seen the presentation before, so I thought it was extremely interesting how you. So your focus is, of course, on liberalism, the chance of sort of getting it right and having something beyond the current deadlock in Bosnia. And it was interesting how you went to sort of citizenship-based democracy and direct democracy in order to go back to liberalism. But I think at some point I lost the connection between, you know, when you gave the three broad definitions of liberalism, so economic, social, political. Not quite sure that you wanted to follow these connections to as you went along. And what I'm getting to as a question is that I'm not quite sure that how you portray the problems of economic liberalism is entirely right, because in some way everything you said about citizen participation in the citizen-based democracy was in some way or another the effect of economic liberalism, even if that was imperfectly applied. So either the winners of corruption, so economic liberalism created rents, which were then unequally distributed, so the elites were sort of united across ethnic lines, and then the people demonstrating were also united across ethnic lines. I think you mentioned so trans-ethnic and so in that sense, liberalism, economic liberalism, works to create the conditions for political and social liberalism. It just takes time. I mean, you know, it won't happen overnight anyway. So, am I completely wrong?
Well, I mean, economic liberalism works in producing outrage and producing winners and losers. And if that, I mean, if democratic pluralism is what you expect, you can say, of course, yeah, economic liberalism divides up winners and losers, and then you can leave it. But my point was more that as a result of these deregulation, privatization processes, and so on, the social basis for the people was removed, something that they had known from the Yugoslav times, as a kind of this net of social security was removed, while this kind of I try to avoid the word casino capitalism. So came in and actually just stripped the companies for parts and so on. And then the people that actually have jobs, they work for rather little money, and they are not oftentimes not paid. Their social benefits are not paid, and all these kind of stuff is a direct result of the notion of privatizing. And in fact, if you look at the private, I mean, the factories were owned by collectives in Bosnia, and the decision to make them state property so that you could privatize them afterwards was taken by the Bosnian parliament, if I'm not wrong, in 1994. So while the war was still going on, and while some of us might have thought that there are more present issues to be dealt with than actually making this collectively owned companies state-owned companies. And then, of course, all the people were kind of pushed out of this economic market. And because then the people that came in to own these companies were not really interested in developing them. And at the same time, the international community put much emphasis on building up the state structures. If you wanted to have a job, it basically meant working for the state in one form or another. And today, still about, I mean, I've seen different estimates. One study says 86% of the people work for the state, which I've seen in the newspaper published. I don't believe that it's like that, but I think some 60% probably of Bosnians are employed by state institutions. And that's because the public sector does not hold up its bargain, and that is my criticism to neoliberalism, that it has lost focus this market mechanism to produce economic growth does not actually work in the context of Bosnia. But that's a...
I can go back to that. Follow up.
Yeah, of course.
Open it up and then we can go back. I'll take question first. You? And then.
Thank you, Alice, for the presentation. I'm Daniela Villatelli.
Yes, of course, yeah.
I have a question which is kind of connected to what you were discussing about the different dimensions of liberalism and how that plays out in the modern context specifically. And I was wondering whether you think that those dimensions, in what way are they related to one another, and if you see, is one more important than the other, are there any tensions that you can anticipate between them? And I'll give you an example. You talked about the protest, and as you know, I studied that as well, and in my own in my PhD. And what I found was that one of the things that emerged from the protest was that Bosnian people really wanted international organizations as well to care about socioeconomic issues in the country. But the way in which the European Union specifically tried to address those economic demands was more was not probably addressing the concerns that the protesters raised in the way the protesters wanted them to be addressed. So the way in which the European initiative developed through the growth and jobs and the reform agenda that the government is now trying to implement the international organization thought that the way of addressing the protest concerns was important. Because the way in which economic liberalism is perceived as related to political liberalism perhaps does not allow the international community to address those concerns in the way the civil movement has to be addressed. And at the same time, I was thinking, if your proposal for addressing the shortcomings of... I'm sorry, I also lost my... If your proposal for addressing the shortcomings of liberalism is to increase sort of social justice provisions in the country, how is that compatible with economic liberalism? If economic liberalism means a loss of revenue for the state because there is more liberalization of the market and monetization, how can you then fund those social justice programs? If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Can I respond?
Yes.
Right away.
It was a long question.
Yeah, thank you very much for this question. And of course, I know your work. In fact, I remember I was discussing at one of the panels where you presented precisely this idea of the international organizations actually coming in and imposing a certain narrative on the protest movement. And thank you for the question about the three categories. Of course, there is tension between these three categories. And I have kind of brushed over this tension because I did not want to elaborate on these points. But I think there is something to be said about the core of political liberalism that has to be that anybody calling it him or herself a liberal needs to subscribe to. And that this is basically the notion of you have a system of accountability between the government, you have a prohibition for state coercion, and you have individual inalienable rights that the state, and that not only the state, but even democracy may not touch. Because what we think today as liberal democracy is actually some kind of an oxymoron, because liberals were rather skeptical about the notion of democracy, because they thought it was the rule by the tyranny of the majority, and that it would lead to mediocre rule. So they accepted it under two conditions. The first one was public education, because to actually work, you need a citizenry that understands what it's doing. And the second point was that these inalienable rights do not only protect you from state coercion, but also from democratic coercion, in the sense. So that's one thing. And of course, you're absolutely right this is the core of political liberalism that everybody has to accept. Now, in what form that happens, representative democracy and so on, is, I think, a second step removed from that. And that may be compatible with other things, or it may lead to problems. And of course, there is a strong discompatibility between economic liberalism, at least as I have presented it here, because I thought this is basically the EU model. You know, the Copenhagen criteria, competitiveness, competition, I think comes closest to this neoliberal understanding. But you have also like a Keynesian model of economics and so on that may take into account these social, the inefficiencies of the market, if you want it like that. So there are, but of course, in a pure reading, as I've presented here, there are these incompatibilities between those three, and I thought long about them, and it would, but I can send you something, it's just like 20 pages about what to do. And then you also have, within political liberalism, I mean, you have this libertarian position versus the more liberal democratic one and so on. So none of these is as straightforward as I presented. But, you know, at the end of the day, I'm a political scientist and I need categories.
Yeah.
So you have to reduce it, as I said, substantially to... Yeah. Yeah, I see these, but I don't think that they are situated on a theoretical level. They can be resolved theoretically. Now, in practice, and the international organizations, of course, I mean, I am one of those people who actually defends the European Union in this case, because the European Union is a machinery. There is an institutional framing for the European Union, and it has certain limits as to how to actually engage in a particular context. And if these limits do not allow for certain actions, then we have to understand that. We may criticize that, but it's not a priori. I don't really know how this notion of the European Union has to treat us in a particular way. It has to talk to us rather than talking to the political elites. I don't think that works practically, because the European Union is under a lot of constraints itself. So I'm a bit more defensive on the European Union side, but I take your point.
Eric?
I'd like to ask about the social and cultural context. Uh-huh. Because a lot of what you've described as proposals and as movements in the country have to do with demands for democracy.
Mm-hmm.
The basic problem of democracy is the strength of these politicized ethno-national communities. And it seems like we like very much to make the assumption that politicized ethno-national communities are a product of the war or of the Dayton Agreement. But if we go back a bit further, you know, during the communist period, there were also demands for political democracy, to which the communists generally had an answer. They said, yes, we could have political democracy, but then communities would divide up into ethno-national communities that would be in conflict with one another, and this might end with violence. So if you don't want the country to experience violence again, the price that you have to pay for it is to maintain the rule of a single party. And looking back, it seems often that the communists may have been right. If it is the case that there is a strong inclination for people to form into ethno-national communities, you know, rather than, as many political theorists would like to assume, into communities of social democrats and conservatives and heaven knows what else. So the big question is then, yes, do you really want democracy?
Thank you very much, Eric, for this question, which is, of course, the million-dollar question. I mean, what if these people don't want... I would slightly disagree with your characterization of the communist system, particularly as it pertains to Bosnia and Herzegovina, because there is a forthcoming book by Sevan Pearson, and there was also an argument by Hannes Grantitz, I think, who actually says... I mean, Pearson looks at this wonderful conundrum from a theoretical point of view. Why did the communists agree for the Bosnian Muslims to become a nation rather than remaining an ethnic community? I mean, it's completely counter to the communist ideology of actually overcoming the national and so on, because the communists, at least after World War II, believed that these national questions are rather secondary to the division of power between labor and between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. And when, once this is solved out, the other thing was done. And he actually shows how the communists reacted to demands for more democracy by strengthening indirectly the ethnic component of the thing. So I would not put the Yugoslav experience as a kind of a thing supporting your case that these ethno-national communities have always been there. And in fact, what we refer to as the ethnic key in Bosnia was not necessarily an ethnic key, it was a social key. Yes, the communists in Bosnia wanted to have Serbs, Croats, and Muslims included in the government, but they also wanted to have a lower-ranking worker, academics, and so on, up to a particular proportion. So it's kind of a view of history that we put after the fact on the reading of history. Now, all this does not invalidate your central question of what to do. First of all, I think that even if you accept that people want to have ethno-national communities, you have to accept the fact that free ethno-national communities in Bosnia having their own territories is impossible. It's just not feasible territorially to divide them up and to give everybody its state or even an entity of their own, even though Republika Srpska might be an exception to that. So once you realize that there has to be some cooperation between the three groups, regardless of what you presuppose is there, the origin, the question becomes, what is the best ordering mechanism for that? And I don't think that even if you assume political ethnic communities, that you can circumvent what Rawls calls the democratic doctrinal pluralism. He says, in order for a system to actually work, if we assume that they are individuals that define themselves however they want in a pluralist way, some of them in an ethnic way, some of them in social democratic and so on, the best ordering mechanism for this kind of system is liberalism, or is liberal, in the sense that it gives everybody an airing and lets these things in the domain of the private home. Now, I don't think that these political ethno-national communities is a reality. That's simply my simple answer, because the case of Brčko in Bosnia shows that probably these people were really happy in the first 10 post-war years when the median income in Brčko was three or four times as high as it was in the rest of the country, because the internationals put a lot of money in that and developed the infrastructure. So I don't think... I think it's not a question of demand, it's a question of supply. But if you're right, then we need to shift to a completely different discussion.
Okay. A question for Tmir.
My question is similar to the previous one. Actually, when you made your presentation, at least I didn't follow that focusing on ethnical issues, and we know that what happened in Yugoslavia, Bosnia and other, and still it's the challenge, the relevance in political sense, because when you started to turn the studies, you mentioned on liberalism in Bosnia and Herzegovina and also in the Balkans, it has not been an issue of lack of political liberalism, but prevalence of economic liberalism and the deficits in or lack of social. But how do you see this liberalism in the context of, you just referred on some of these issues on the ethnical aspect. So how do we get this balance? And I saw you mentioning on the concluding remarks, referring to your colleague, that if we repeat this bottom-up process, then we create these divergences in the society, in the community. So do you think that this model of when you present the liberalism within the conception of democracy, how is this sustainable in the new challenges that we face in the Balkans? How we can see a sustainable model? Because we see the model, existing model, for 20 years. Actually, we have reached some peace in the region, but the challenges are there. And that has a feedback effect on the also in the economic sense. You can have a neoliberalism, but what it ends up, not economic growth that we expect, but the divergence in the society. Then we have these domino effects. So my question is on this, how do you, in your research, how do you see this in terms of ethnical divergence that we have in the Balkans?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can give a similar answer to the question before. I mean, this is the most important question, but I we have been thinking about the Balkans in these ethnic terms for now 20 years, and I think what we have come up with is not satisfactory. If you look, nobody has presented the one model that actually works, apart from even in homogeneous societies. I mean, I spoke about Bosnia, but of course you have similar tendencies of state capture in Macedonia, you have them in Serbia, you have them certainly in Montenegro, and you know, these are not unique issues that are pertaining to Bosnia in the sense, of course, the consociational system makes it even worse because it allows a direct state capture as opposed to these things that had to develop in these other cases. And I believe that this notion that we have to start with an ethnic understanding of things and then ask ourselves how can we do that is slightly, I mean, we have done that for 20 years, it didn't work, firstly, and secondly, why should it work? I mean, shouldn't we think about other alternatives given that it did not work? And that's my point. I mean, it's not negating that, but it's saying even if you accept this, there might be other issues that actually transcend this. And this was the direct democratic example. If you put on a vote in a local municipality, say you have a million euros, what to do with €1 million? And somebody says, let's actually build a street through this quarter because it's dark outside, we need street lights and maybe one or two roundabouts or whatever. Let's develop this quarter. And then the people living in that quarter would presumably be for it. People who are a bit outside say, no, they should develop our quarter and so on. And it would not necessarily be an ethnic issue. So it would divide up the population in a different way. And I think what the protests have shown and what all other action, even by the political elites, has shown is that there are other issues that trump the ethnic issue. So I think we owe it to ourselves to actually put forward models that are non-ethnic. Like at least in a theoretical framework.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you for the presentation. I was just wondering, I'm looking forward to seeing the full text. But I was just wondering, what would you say are the key steps from today, from the reality of today, to that ideal picture that you see? I don't know if you have it in the full text, but this. There is something missing here, and it's the big problems generated by dysfunctionalities of the Peace Implementation Council, which runs the mechanism that is a part of our constitution.
Mm. Well, this is I think you called me out on something that I knew was lacking in the thing, because I do a sleight of hand here. Like I say, this is the situation, this is the solution, and we should do this, but I don't actually address how to get from here to there. And this is very well caught. And I sometimes think when I get this question, it's not the first time that I get it, of course. I sometimes think if you read John Locke's Second Treatise of Government, he says, you know, the peace without the state without of nature without a state is a peaceful state, but then something happens and it becomes a state of war. And once it is a state of war, you cannot go back. So his solution is actually to never let the state of war happen. And of course, I feel somehow that we are in the same discussion. If we had done this in 1995, we might have been somewhere different, but now we have this and we're there. And to be perfectly honest with you, the only way forward that I see in this context is kind of a mixed bottom-up and top-down approach to actually force the elites on providing these reforms that are necessary. So citizens need actually to pressure them from below with concrete demands on what they want to achieve, while the European Union has to actually say, and they are doing this with this. There is the Friedrich, the German foundation, Friedrich Ebert Stiftung, that has actually produced a series of articles saying the reform agenda. What it will concretely change in a person's life, rather than saying it is necessary for. So if you have that, and that creates a bottom-up process, so you have to explain, and then you kind of can sandwich the leaders and not open up other avenues for that. I think that's the only, as Stojanovic says with respect to direct democracy, it's a long-term, slow-moving process, but it's the only process that I can see that can be sustainable.
What's the, yes?
Well, I have a question that would be coming from psychology, actually. This thing that I'm going to observe it on. When you speak about a citizen, I understand that in order to produce kind of political actor or a citizen, a person who has the confidence to take part and say their opinion and think that this counts, you need this kind of political culture that you trust that nothing is going to happen to you physically, that you are, that people listen to what you say, because it depends how groups coordinate maybe. The fact that you listen to me now, it's like a process. So are there already existing these types of interactions where people can express what they think publicly, sort of public space? Can this be encouraged to create some political culture where people will have the possibility to become citizens, not just by voting like once, or every time in many referendums,
but me. I think that the forums were the first instances where this happened on a larger scale. I mean, there have been both efforts by the citizens to organize this, and particularly in the urban centers. I mean, I lived in Sarajevo for 6 months, and every week you could go to some kind of gathering where people would discuss, rather the forthcoming liberal elites would discuss political issues and put forward proposals and so on. But those were rather localized little things, and the protests made it a bit more open to everybody. And then on the other hand, there was, I know, after Miroslav Lajčák became office high representative in 2006, in 2006 after Schwarz-Schilling left, he actually realized that you cannot impose this process of Europeanization anymore. So he started reaching out to the public, and there was a website called Reciba, like sayit.ba, and there was like when they wanted to start a dialogue with the European Union, kind of on the citizens, and there are outreach programs by the European Union. I'm not familiar how structured, how well attended they are nowadays, but I would say everything that happens there is minimal. And something that's also seen in the protest movement, I mean, I come from a rather rural area in northern Bosnia, and what happens in Sarajevo, Banja Luka, or even in the eastern part of Republika Srpska or Mostar, does not really translate to the everyday lives of the people there. So I think that it's rather localized, and these issues have been confined to the urban centers. But I agree with you. I mean, there is a need to educate the public, to actually make them aware of the stuff, and actually provide them with opportunities to engage, to create what Rousseau has called the civic religion.
Yes.
But how to do it on and what forums? Is not the question.
It's time for me to go back to my question. We have a bit of time, so I'll interrogate you a bit more on this. I think we're evolving more or less very much to the same issue. I think the premise that, you know, given the circumstances and how, you know, for real reasons or for perceived reasons, the country is divided along mm-hmm. ethnic lines and obviously constitutionally as well. So to then have a sort of a program to increase sort of citizenship participation and social justice and this feeling of citizenship, solidarity, whatever, it surely must go against the real problem of distribution, because power and rents, if you want, the distribution of wealth, of money, goes through the ethnic sort of office holders, even, you know, in terms of public sector jobs or in terms of access to even competitive available funding. There's an access constraint there. So at the moment, the ethnos distributes. And then to say that, well, we need to create a demos which will distribute and redistribute democratically through welfare state or through participatory democracy or whatever, seems to me to be a huge step. And in that sense, I think, in defense of economic liberalism, the market is the thing that will distribute, and then it will create interest structures such that will require political deliberation, which will eventually, after 50 years, result in a good demos, democracy. So to me, it seems quite simple, although not very optimistic. So,
No, I mean, I accept your belief in economic liberalism. I just I see something different in the field. That's point number one, and the point number two, to actually subscribe to your logic would mean that everything the protest movements have been saying is some kind of misguided, because we need just to give the whole thing more time to actually calculate itself. Now I think what you're conflating here is a control. Because I thought economic liberalism, in an economic, the state should really just ensure the framework rather than to be directly engaged in it. And then if you say the ethnos distributes it, then you're kind of contradicting your own point by saying it will resolve itself over the, because if the political side of the issue is not tackled, you cannot let the market run freely. I mean, and my major point here is that the market itself does not run freely, and the market is under political constraints because the state is still the biggest jobs provider in the country, and in order to be part of the state, you have to be part of the ethnos, and then the question is even more complicated, because you have these ethnically segregated schools. That means that people think the ethnos is something naturally occurring and stuff like that, so you have the self-perpetuating effect of the whole thing. Now, to say that the ethnos distributes and then you go to the market and the market will distribute, I would question the capability of the market to distribute something fairly in general terms. But we can say over a period of 50 years that might happen. But the thing is, if you don't cross-cut this ethnos, I don't see a chance for liberalism. And I was not saying that liberalism, that we should actually go from today to a liberal democratic. I'm just saying, if we want liberalism, liberal democracy, to have any chance, any fighting chance in this battle about Bosnia's future, this is the way how to do it. I'm personally also struggling with the thing of dismantling these ethnic institutions. But then again, I mean, you can put so many other narratives on the Bosnian story. And I know that our colleague Jasmin Mujana, which is coming out now with a book that says actually since the 18th century, the biggest conflict in the Balkans has not been ethnic diversity, but it has been that you had like a ruling class that took everything for itself, be it in form of the monarchy, in form of the communist elite, and so, and you had the people that were always disenfranchised in some form. So you can put different spins on the history of the Balkans, and I don't see why this ethnic category should, first of all, I don't see why this ethnic category should be permanent, because we have seen cases where ethnicity has kind of eroded, Switzerland being one of them over the last 150 years. when being a Catholic or a Protestant in Switzerland 100 years ago was a real distinctive mark. And Switzerland is always portrayed as this country that has never had a war, when in fact it had four religious wars since the 14th century. And three of those were won by the Catholics and the last one by the Protestants. So that's why we have a rather liberal system. So you know, I mean all this perpetuity of categories I would question. And I think everything is constructed in the sense that it is self-perpetuated to be in a certain way. I mean, I was recently, I think Ivor Roberts spoke here as well some time ago, and he spoke at Oxford, and there was this question from the audience: was Yugoslavia kind of a country destined to fail because of its ethnic diversity? And he said, yeah, it seems like that it was not going to work to bring all these countries in a peculiar setting. And then we have to say, well, is the UK a country destined to fail? I mean, how can we have a unified Germany in 1871 without things? All these things are kind of constructed in a way that the construction seems permanent to us because we have gotten used to this. And in fact, I mean, I'm not innocent in that. If you read my book, everything is based on there being these ethnic differences and there being there. But I think for the future, we need to question these things. And I think there are legitimate ways to question. I'm not sure about the market, though.
We can continue this discussion after the seminar. I think if there's no more questions, I will pursue that individually. Okay, please join me in thanking Andris for the presentation.
Thank you very much.
And before you leave the room, just to announce that we continue with our next seminar in 2 weeks' time on the 14th of March. Maja Gerovska Mitev from the University of St. Cyril and Methodius in Skopje, Macedonia, will be talking about challenges for activation policies in the Western Balkans, much more economically inspiring topic, but she's a social policy person, so there's not going to be much economics, I promise.